from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a preview of what Indie Folk Series has planned for this spring.
I'll talk with author Larry Swayze about his latest mystery.
And I'll chat with author Abe Amador about his latest novel. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Folk Series impresarios Dan Henkel and Phil Slates love to talk folk music in all its ever-evolving forms. Sharon Gamble invited Dan and Phil to our studios to talk about the second half of their 15th season.
I'm glad you were able to come back, Dan, to talk about the second half of the series, and you brought the Charles in charge of booking. Thank you, Phil. You've had that responsibility for a while for Indie Folk Series.
You're correct. A couple of years now.
And how did you become the point person for booking?
I paid Dan a lot of money. This is kind of interesting. Dan and I have gone back way, way back in the days when there was a guitar store in Broad Ripple, and I sold and he bought and stuff like that. So it was just kind of natural. Once my wife and I and some other friends got involved with the series, and Dan was looking to take a load off. And I knew a lot of bands. So he said, hey, how'd you like to do that? And the rest, as they say, is history.
There we go. You were about halfway through the season, and the Underhills are coming up shortly, mm-hmm. in a few weeks. Tell us about the Underhills.
Well, oddly enough, there's a connection there. One of the gentlemen is the son of Tim Grimm, who is Connor Grimm. And but we have heard them independent of that. And they are just Dan and I were talking earlier about the variety of things, and of course we're based in back in the Peter, Paul, and Mary days, and yet we're trying to get across that our series is a whole lot of different kinds of music. Earlier this year we had Appalatin, which is a combination of Latin and Appalachian music, which was quite different.
Which wasn't around a few decades ago.
Exactly. And so Underhills are a bunch of young guys, and they're certainly deeply rooted in the beginnings of folk music, and yet they take it off on another aspect. They have and I can't remember the title of it, but they have an interesting tune which sounds pretty classical folk until it's, instead of lyrics or singing, it's spoken word, and it just kind of comes in and out. And first time I heard it, I said, wow, that's a different way.
So that's even a little hip-hop influence then.
Exactly.
See, I think that we put music in some boxes because it's convenient, but every time I hear a new Mumford & Sons track, I think, you know, that's not that far from folk, mm-hmm. especially some of the instruments.
Sure.
And
it's a very broad continuum. And one of the great joys for me is hearing the results of these mashups of people's different interests and styles and influences.
Yeah.
So a lot of these younger musicians, the singer-songwriters, the bands that we'll hear, who knows what they're listening to that informs their music on top of what's usually a base of the roots music that kind of is common to all of us that we like.
So that's so fun that that our American art form of roots and folk music continues to grow and evolve.
Mm-hmm. It's the folk process, as Pete Seeger has often said.
Yeah. So I love the name of Wild Carrot in March. Tell us about Wild Carrot.
Well, it's a husband and wife team along with a couple of their friends, and they're, again, a different part of it. They're a little showier, if you will, much more of a polished presentation. But then again, that there's a place for that everywhere, and their songs mm-hmm. are dead on, and the musicianship is very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
She's a guitarist, and he's a guitarist, and then they have bass and fiddle with them. A couple of young people joining them to fill in on that. So it'll be a fun evening, and a lot of hilarity going on with this group, too.
And there might be a concertina as part of the... Instrumentation?
There, it says so, so I believe
it says so in the brochure.
You never know what people will bring.
Right, right.
You hear their albums, you see their promotional materials. There may be 12 different instruments they play. They may bring 15, they may bring 3. They sometimes bring other artists with them. Mm-hmm. You just never know what it'll be because it's live.
And there's a deadline for the brochure, so you have to take your best guess and move on.
Sure.
Yeah.
But now that I've brought it up, I should ask you all to define, for somebody who's like, concertina, I used to know what that is. What is a concertina?
Well, think of a teeny accordion without the piano-type keys on it. It's a little handheld instrument, a little squeeze box, maybe kind of octagonal in shape, and think of them onboard sailing ships.
And
they have buttons on each end.
Yeah, that's how the notes are shaped.
So
yeah.
It's a reed instrument. It's fixed reeds. Yeah. And as you squeeze in and out, you get different tones.
Cool. Phil, you know, I'm famous for putting Dan on the spot, and every 2 or 3 years when we do these interviews, I ask him to define folk music, mostly to see if his definition has changed at all. How would you define folk music?
Well, the easiest thing, of course, is to say it is music of the folk or music.
Hey, that's a cheap way out.
Well,
stop that.
Hey, you know,
we tried that in 1988.
What does that mean? What folk?
The folk that you like. It's of the people, and it's although people go into studios and they have producers and stuff, it's not a terribly overproduced type of music, and yet again you look at some of the various people we've had. Some people have had quite a bit of production going on in their things. I don't know. To me, it's kind of like it speaks to the heart. It speaks to issues that we all truly really have, you know, not whether we're going to get some bullying today or something like that. It's just speaks to things. And then, of course, it does have a tradition.
Right,
after Wild Carrot, we have the Hounds of Finn, and they're a very Celtic-infused group. And so a lot of their stuff is going to speak to Irish or Celtic type stuff, although – again, these youngsters, they run it up a notch, and it'll be breathtaking. Really.
I think there was a time, it's been a number of years ago now, but when you didn't necessarily expect to find any electrified instruments in folk music.
Yeah, I think there was that, and of course we even call ourselves a great place for acoustic music, but we've had last year we had the Accidentals, which a two-girl group. Who had to have an older girl with them to be able to, you know, rent a car.
Hmm.
They had some of the standard instrumentations, and then they had some electric guitars and an electric cello. And then just the technology of the day anymore. Almost everybody who plays guitar, acoustic guitar, has got it wired up now. It's just much easier. Mostly your sound people in the live world are really based on rock. And they do a good job of an acoustic guitar through a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a little more control if you can just hand them a plug and say, here, plug this in somewhere. And that kind of stuff.
But you tend to find people wanting guitars to sound like acoustic guitars.
Exactly.
And you want the fiddles and the mandolins and the flutes to sound real.
Right.
So the electronics let you capture and amplify that sound more reliably than if you had a really loud instrument next to a very soft instrument.
Do very many of your artists record or ask you to record the concerts they do with you?
We have actually had a couple of CDs, albums put out from live performances at the Indie Folk Series. Bittersweet and Briars did it. Hogeye Navi did it.
Two great local groups. Don't do that so much anymore.
Sometimes the bands will arrange with Carl Zemlin, our audio guru, to record some tracks that then they may go and mix and sweeten up a bit and publish on their own.
Neat. And Phil, how often, I'm guessing that the way all music works, folk music works, so you're talking with an artist that you've booked for this season and they say, by the way, do you know, my cousin has this band you should know about. Does that happen?
There's a certain amount of that. Then we go to it's Folk Alliance Regional Midwest, which is a part of the overall International Folk Alliance. And we go to that once a year, and so we're running into all sorts of performers, and there somebody will say, hey, so-and-so's down in the next room. You know, you ought to go down there and listen to him.
So, sure.
But, yes, you're right, especially in the local scene. You know, somebody say, you know, in fact, we booked – who did we book here? We booked Appalachian solely on the recommendation of a local artist that we respect.
Cool.
We had not seen them and hadn't heard them, but we, you know, we got enough glowing reports, and it fit our goal of having different things under the folk genre.
Exactly, mixing it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And your audience probably sometimes brings you artists too, right?
True. Our audience, and then we have a great bunch of volunteers, all very diverse in their musical interest. And I can't tell you much more than that, but we have something coming up for the following season, and we definitely polled everybody about their input for that. We get a lot of, and then, you know, on our website, it says, hey, if you want a booking, you know, plug in here. And so mm-hmm. I go through every week and wade through, you know.
Phil has a very large collection of CDs that he never wants to hear again. And a few real gems.
Yeah.
But to me, that speaks to the strength of the movement. There's so many creative people out there. Anybody can produce an album.
Absolutely.
Now. Everybody's got an idea of their own sound. And so it's a very fertile scene, and maybe not all of it is suitable for the indie folk series,
right.
But some of it is, and I think the future looks very bright for this musical collaboration.
I think you've just articulated some sort of swap room that needs to happen at the Midwest Folk Alliance in the next event. Hounds of Finn, a little bit of Celtic infusion, and where are they based? Where are they from?
You know, I believe they're Ohio-based.
I think that's correct.
Yeah,
that's
right. So just next door.
Yeah.
And then tell us about Heather Pearson, your solo performer at the in your May concert.
Actually, it appears in the brochure that she's solo, but she will be in a three-piece fiddle and bass.
Oh, cool.
And it's another one of these Folk Alliance finds. She was at the big performer stage late in the evening, last one there, and we were just so knocked out by her songwriting. She plays a little guitar, but mostly piano,
mm-hmm.
and she does drift. You know, you were asking about what is folk. Well,
yeah.
She drifts over into the jazz side of folk. But it's the songwriting, the compelling stories that she tells, and we were very happy that, you know, this is where you find somebody at a place like that, and you just go, oh, please, you know, come to our venue.
And
yeah.
Phil, Heather Pearson embodies to me something that I've really liked among the artists that you found for us, mm-hmm. which is very high instrumental values. I am, frankly, more interested in instrumental music than vocal music, although I participate in both. And we've gotten really good musical chops in all of these bands.
Mm-hmm.
So you may find someone who will strum a simple three-chord song that they wrote one time, and then they may lit into a wonderful instrumental piece or switch to another instrument.
Interesting. Because I think in a lot of people's minds, singer-songwriter and folk music are synonymous, but that doesn't mean that all folk music has vocals.
Certainly not. Yeah. We've had sometimes great acoustic jazz, which I love, the mm-hmm. Django Reinhardt
yeah.
tradition.
Yeah. So remind us about kind of the atmosphere of the concerts.
Well, to me, it's a little bit like the coffee houses of old. We have a wonderful room with art on the walls and comfortable chairs, still have some tables and candles, and a great sense of the artists speak of a loop where they can hear people listening.
Hmm.
It's a real listening room. You're free to, people sing along. They bring their children. People dance along. They come and go. They get some refreshments. But it's all very much focused on the music and a casual enjoyment of that.
So what's your favorite part of being involved with Indie Folk Series?
I don't know that I can boil it down to one thing because it's it's the people. The people that I volunteer with, like Dan and the others that we associate with all the time. It's the people that we get to meet. It's the joy. I know a lot of people out on the road who are traveling and they maybe just came from a bar with chicken wire in front of the stage, and they come to our venue, and we treat them right, and, you know, we set up the sound for them, and it's all ready to go. And then you see, oh, they're going to have a good time, and they're going to give our audience a good time. And I like our audience. I mean, a lot of people are repeat audience members, and then we're always excited to see somebody new. And, in fact, something that's bringing new people in, we're doing something new this year, which is called a new music preview. And as you said, you know, people recommending somebody, you know, for, hey, I got a mm-hmm. band or whatever. Well,
yeah.
We only have so many performances in a year. So this is something where we bring live performers, local performers, into the lobby area where we have snacks and everything, and people wait for the main room to open up. And they entertain, and I mean, and I'm honest with them. I say it'll be kind of a chatty atmosphere. It's not going to be as much of listening. But we've had some really, really great people. We had a group called the Match Sellers all the way from Warsaw, Indiana, come down. And in a month, I think we're going to have Cyrus Youngman and the Kingfishers, who are a popular folk rocker
group. And we've had the Slates family band.
Oddly enough.
Who are those? And his brother and the Associated Wives.
There you go.
It was lots of fun.
But people say that they enjoy that. It's you know, it's a little music ahead of the thing, and we allow the performers to, if they've got CDs, you know, sell CDs or merchandise or whatever. And so it's a win for them, and it's just another way that we can present more people in or more music in the limited number of shows that we put on.
Sharon Gamble with Indie Folk Series Dan Henkel and Phil Slates. You can learn more at indiefolkseries.org. That's indiefolkseries.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Author Larry D. Swayze writes both Westerns and mysteries and has won numerous awards for his novels and short stories. His 11th novel, A Thousand Falling Crows, was just released and is the Library Journal's Mystery Pick of the Month for January of this year. Travis DiNicola spoke with him about his new book.
Larry, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Always great to see you.
Travis, it's always great to be here and spend some time with you.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Yeah, a great way to start the new year. You just released a new mystery, A Thousand Falling Crows. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really excited about this book.
This is this sounds like a really cool book. It's a mystery, but it also has connections back to the work you've done as a Western writer. And we're going to get to that in just a second, but tell me about the title.
A Thousand Falling Crows. The main character, Sonny Burton, is a World War I veteran. So this book's set in 1933 in Wellington, Texas, in the Dust Bowl. And Sonny Burton is, he's affected by the war and by his experiences as a Texas Ranger. And there was a saying, we call it post-traumatic stress syndrome. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was the thousand-yard stare.
Okay, sure, sure.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So I kind of incorporated, that's kind of where the thousand came from. And there's a really dark character in this book. So, and there's also crows who are kind of a Greek chorus.
Okay.
Serve as a Greek chorus and in an omniscient point of view. So A Thousand Falling Crows,
And I know in the book there's some bodies that are found in fields, and crows often hang out in fields, and so I'm sort of making that connection there, too. And you actually had some crows at a recent book signing you did, or you had a crow, is that right?
Yes, actually, Edgar Allan Crow.
Edgar Allan Crow. Yes. So not a raven, but a crow.
A crow. Okay. We have crows here, which thanks to Liz and Chris Hatton, who are wild bird rehabbers in Westfield, I spend some time with them, and they have an education bird, Edgar, who lives with them. Mm-hmm. And
who's also well-read.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He reads poetry. He also writes, too, if he finds a pencil. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yes, Edgar came with me. And actually, when I was writing this book, it was really nice to get up close and personal with a crow.
So you actually, as you're writing, because crows feature in the book, you went and consulted with Edgar Allan Crow?
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You know, you are a researcher.
It comes natural. You know, every book or every idea starts with what if. And, you know, and then you can fall into a rabbit hole of, you know, crows. Or the Depression, or the Dust Bowl, or Texas Rangers, which I obviously can't seem to get away from. Yes, I love to do research. I love to ask that question. It's that insatiable curiosity, I think, that all writers and creative people have.
And this one started actually with a story, a real life story that you had read about Bonnie and Clyde, right?
Absolutely.
Tell me a bit about that, because I know that was sort of the inspiration for what you started with, and then you brought in this character and then the rest of it.
Yeah. Bonnie and Clyde were coming out of a movie theater in Wellington, Texas in 1933, June 11th, 1933, which is where I start the book and insert my fictional character. But they are recognized, and they get into a shootout with the sheriff, the county sheriff, and into a chase. And Clyde takes a side road and goes off a bridge that's not fully constructed and crashes the car. And the battery, the car battery, mm-hmm. flies up through the windshield and lands on Bonnie's leg.
Ugh.
And severely burns her with the battery acid because... Oh. It's, you know, batteries were a lot different back
sure.
then than they are now. So really, for the last year of Bonnie Parker's life, mm-hmm. she either hopped where she went
mm-hmm.
or she Clyde was carrying her.
He would carry her around.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's something that, you know, I mean, a lot of us know the story of Bonnie and Clyde mainly from the movie.
Yeah.
I certainly don't remember that scene.
No, I don't think that scene was in there. But, you know, the sheriff came and, of course, they wrecked the car and then... Mm-hmm. Clyde took him hostage, and they tied him. They took him. He stole the sheriff's car, and that's how he escaped. He and Bonnie escaped.
Man, she must have been in horrible pain.
Yes, yeah. Ugh. But it would have been worse to have gotten caught.
Yeah,
in their mind, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't turn out real well for him. We know how that story ended. But I read that story, and I really liked that idea of using that event, which is something that I've done with my Josiah Wolf books,
mm-hmm.
is inserted him into real situations.
And Josiah Wolf, if I just may interrupt for a moment, is the Texas Ranger. This is your Western series that's set in the 1800s.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There were six books in that series, and it ended. So
now you have a new Texas Ranger character in a different century.
Right.
And so it's this... older Texas Ranger character, and so you've inserted him into what begins with this Bonnie and Clyde story.
Right. And he gets shot.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately his arm is amputated, his right arm. And of course, you know, writers always make things as bad as they can for their mm-hmm. their main characters.
You guys are mean.
I know. And he's right-handed.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to learn how to decide whether he's going to live. How he's going to live his life, the rest of his life.
He's obviously not able to be a Texas Ranger anymore.
Right. So he's no longer a ranger.
Mm-hmm.
While he's in the hospital, he meets the janitor, Aldo Hernandez, and they kind of strike up a friendship because Sonny was kind of raised by a Mexican woman. And Aldo's daughter gets pulled into a bad situation with two brothers that kind of want to be, you know, gangsters or criminals or mm-hmm. whatever, and they kind of fill the vacuum that Bonnie and Clyde left. And she runs off with them. So Aldo eventually goes and enlists Sonny's help reluctantly.
The daughter runs off with
yeah,
these two bad guys,
yeah.
And so now Sonny is sort of brought back out of retirement.
Out of and given purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To get on with his life and
okay.
do what he knows how to do. So unfortunately it doesn't turn out well for everyone, but
mm-hmm.
you know, that's kind of how those things go. But that's kind of the gist of the story.
I find it really interesting that I mean, you often write, not necessarily historical fiction, but work that does take place in the past, whether your Westerns or also, your Marjorie Tremaine, mystery series, which takes place in the early 60s.
Correct.
You know, so here you're going back to 1933, and, you know, it sounds in some ways like kind of a mix of what you've done with both your Westerns and your mysteries, kind of bringing them together a little bit.
Even the Marjorie Tremaine series, which is set in North Dakota,
mm-hmm.
has kind of a Western flavor to it.
Yeah, there's a real open landscape there.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think that's just part of who I am,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really fascinated and have been always fascinated with the West. I am writing a modern day thriller right now.
What?
That's yeah. So, you know, always changing things up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's set in Indiana.
So, oh, good.
Yes.
So when are we looking at that?
Next January.
Next January? Okay. Yes. A year from now, we'll have you
it's
back on for that.
Where I Can See You.
Excellent. Yeah. Cool. Well, I know you also have another Marjorie Tremaine book coming out this spring, which I'm really looking forward to. Your last one of that series was called See Also Murder, and she is just, for me, a really fascinating character, a woman who is she becomes an indexer, a back-of-book indexer, and as a researcher, and as we said, it takes place in the early 60s, but also gets involved in investigating a murder with See Also Murder, and now the new one is See Also
Deception.
Deception. Cool. Yes. I'm looking forward to having her back.
Yes.
Yeah.
That'll be out May 10th. We're going through all the finalization stuff with that now. And I don't want to give too much away, but there's a suicide of a character that appeared in See Also Murder, and Marjorie doesn't believe that it's a suicide.
Okay. And I was going to ask how she gets involved with another murder again, especially in the Dakotas where, there's
not
a lot
people
happening.
And, I know.
It's one thing to have a continuing series with a Texas Ranger. It makes sense. He would, have new adventures, but a back-of-book indexer, you think maybe one big adventure in their life. And,
right. Well,
you got to be careful about not, making it too goofy, but.
Jessica Fletcher in Murder, She Wrote.
I wasn't going to say that, but,
you wouldn't want to go on vacation with her.
Right.
But yeah, that's kind of how Marjorie gets pulled into it, and actually, there's going to be a third book that I'm contracted for, and the plan is at the moment, because I haven't started to write it, is that Marjorie's going to go to New York City.
Okay.
In the heart of publishing in the mid 1960s.
So, sure.
So I mean, she also has that ability as an indexer and as a researcher to kind of move around. So I have.
That makes sense. And right now, I mean, her relationship with the people she's working with who are giving her the back of book index is really just through the phone and mail.
Right.
And so,
and they're based out of New York City, where the heart of publishing is. So, Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's all kind of that's kind of what's going on.
Neat. Well, you know what? Before I let you go, I mean, part of the back of book indexing thing that fascinates me so much is that when you're not writing novels and westerns and mysteries, you're also a back of book indexer yourself. And I know we were just talking last week, and you just finished up a book. Let me see if I can remember this. It was a book on how the fall of communism affected the environment in Romania.
Is that right?
Did I get it?
That's really
awesome.
Good, man. Yeah.
So what's this week?
This week is a 1,000-page technical manual on hardware, computer hardware, software. It's like a certification guide. So
every week it's pretty much almost something different for you in terms of
something different. I just got a possible project today about the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. So that may be next.
So, I mean, when they contact you to do the back of book index, and that means reading through it and actually creating the index and that is included in the published work. Do they contact you first and say, hey, would you be interested in this? Or does it just sort of show up on your doorstep?
No, usually like the book that I got contacted for today, I won't start working on that book until April or May because my schedule kind of fills up pretty quick. I get an email or a phone call and they solicit my work because either I have worked for this publisher or I've been referred.
So once you start working on it, it's not a total surprise.
No.
But it does change all the time.
Sometimes I get rush jobs where I'll get an email and say, a publisher will say, here's a book and I really need the index in a week. Can you do that? And, either yes, I can or no, I can't.
Yeah.
It just depends on my schedule.
Yeah. It's got to be such fascinating work that you do. And I know that, some of the things that you read about and learn, because you cover such a wide variety of topics, history and computers and technology and art and such, some of that shows up in your fiction work as well, right? From things that you learn?
Absolutely. The book I'm writing now is set in modern day, and probably 4 or 5 books ago was a computer forensics book.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll work its way, I'm sure, into this investigation and just the basis of knowledge. But I think it also goes back to just that keeping that curiosity alive and that constant movement and learning of something new.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it all goes into the soup.
Larry, always great to see you. Congratulations on your new books. It's a pleasure.
Thanks. I'm thrilled to be here.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Travis DiNicola with author Larry Swayze. His latest novel is 1,000 Fallen Crows, and it's available at local bookstores. You can also get more information at LarryDSwayze.com, and Swayze is S-W-E-A-Z-Y. So LarryDSwayze.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
All around the city, W-2s are hitting mailboxes, and people are thinking, oh, man, I have to do my taxes soon.
Yes, that's so true.
But we have some things to distract you before you're quite ready to dig into all that paperwork on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
What do you have?
Well, of course, the Winter Magic Fest is going on this weekend at Indie Fringe.
I knew something was missing.
Oh, yeah. They made it disappear. So I'm, obviously, I'm looking forward to that. But after that, coming up in early February and running through Valentine's Day at the Fringe is the show Impressionism by Michael Jacobs by Wisdom 2 Theater Project is going to be doing this show. It's kind of a romantic show that's set in an art gallery and really great script and a really romantic show, but also very smart, too. And that's going to be running from February 4th through the 20th with special performances on Valentine's as well at Fringe.
Fantastic. Hey, in the last year, there's been a ton of interest in Harper Lee's so-called missing novel, which was published last year. And the IRT has excellent timing because they are mounting a production of To Kill a Mockingbird. It opens on January 29th and runs through February 28th. So you have a month, but don't delay too long because tickets are flying out the door, I'm told. And Tim Grimm and Jan Lucas are doing are both in it and doing some music for it. So that's kind of an intriguing aspect of it. IRTLive.com for more info about that.
Very cool. Hey, start planning ahead for Art and Soul 2016 at the Arts Garden. There's going to be a kickoff for the Arts Council's annual celebration of Black History Month, and that starts on Saturday, January 20th with their big kickoff, and then there are events going on pretty much almost every day throughout the month with all different types of performance and music and visual art, and you can get more information at the Arts Council's website.
Hey, Opera's Rising Stars, they are young folks who have auditioned for the Metropolitan Opera National Council, and they are appearing with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra at the Schrott Center for the Arts on Butler's campus next, in a little over a week, on January 30th and January 31st. You can find more at icomusic.org.
Some cool things going on down at University of Indianapolis. They have a symposium, a one-day symposium, exploring the role of the arts in urban renewal, and it's connected to a UND gallery exhibition that opens this weekend on public art in Indianapolis. And so those two things are going on right now. The public art in Indy opens the 19th, runs through February 5th, and then the actual symposium is on February 5th, and you can get more information if you go to the UIndy website.
Fantastic. And don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. The Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indy Arts Guide. Start assembling your taxes, your tax paperwork, and we'll be back with more distraction for you next week on our calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Robert Marklin has always wanted to be a writer. So when he learns about a writer's retreat in southern Indiana, he jumps at the chance to leave his humdrum life behind to join a monastery of writers. That's the premise of Indianapolis writer Abe Amador's new novel, and Sharon Gamble invited Abe in to see where he got his inspiration.
I'm going to ask you to set up the passage you're about to read for us.
A middle-aged man with a kind of a middle-class background in a middle American city, Omaha in this case, always wanted to be a writer and, in fact, had a couple of short stories published in small literary journals. He's going to run away from home. That's what he's decided, to join a commune. The commune is called the Monastery of Writers. Before he does that, though, he goes to a lecture at Creighton University, or attends a lecture, given by a famous writer, fictionalized character by the name of Frank Winston. He wants to hear the great man, as he facetiously refers to him, and he takes note of some of the other people who are in the audience who he thinks also are would-be and want-to-be writers.
Great.
Why do we write? That was the topic of the little seminar being promoted by the English department at Creighton University. I saw the poster for the event in an independent bookstore near the school. A lean woman in a floppy hat had stood in front of the announcement as I looked over her shoulder to read it myself, and I thought to strike up a conversation. "Do you know Winston?" I asked. Frank Winston was the featured speaker at the event. The woman in the felt hat, I only then noticed her stringy blonde hair like seaweed, her skin pink like the inside of fruit, didn't turn to look at me at first when she spoke. "He's critiqued my work," she said. "I saw him at Antioch, Sanibel too, I think. I might go." She moved on before I could engage her further. At least 100 people attended the Creighton seminar, which was offered in a lecture hall on campus with stadium seating. Hardly a seminar, but they had set up microphones down both aisles so guests could come forward and ask questions. The great man stood in front of a projection screen on stage, and he carried a wireless microphone in one hand, a remote control for the projector in the other. "Why do we write?" The title bugged me the first time I saw it. Yet here I was, an attendee. I scanned the lecture hall for the woman in the felt hat. She had stayed with me. She was my mystery lady. Maybe she was a Vassar grad, somebody out of a Mary McCarthy novel. She's had some poems published in the feminist press. "Hello, I'm Penelope. I write poems." I saw several men and women wearing Fidel-type military caps and others sporting a crown of dreadlocks and braids, older gentlemen in Harris tweeds and neatly parted gray hair, too. But I didn't see her. "Why do we write?" Frank Winston began. "Is it because we're artists and can't help it? We were born that way? Or is it because we want to be famous? Say, isn't that Stephen King in the booth over there? Do you think he'll give us his autograph?" "Be honest now. Is that it? Lots of people think we don't care about the art of writing, but only want to be known as writers. Are they right?" Winston locked eyes with an anonymous, invisible someone in the crowd as if to say, "That's it, isn't it? Come on, you know it's true." Then he grew stern-faced, stood proud and erect. "No, none of that is why we write," he said. "We do it because we're the real truthers. There are the doctors and lawyers and engineers and physicists, and there are the truthers, poets and writers such as ourselves, who seek the meaning and purpose of life and all the wisdom and beauty that is in it, but also the monumental folly of so much that we do and own and aspire to be." I looked around at the others in the audience. I saw some consulting their smartphones or whispering to a companion while smiling. But for many of the others, they continued sitting anxiously, almost impatiently, waiting for Frank Winston to get to the only talking point they cared about. "When will I be published?" That's what they all wanted to know. There was to be a reception for Winston after the lecture. That's when they might slip him a manuscript or just a key to a hotel room, but only if they'd paid $75 extra to attend the reception. No one would dare stand up during the Q&A after the talk and ask that critical question, though. "When will I be published?" It would be too humiliating.
So, do you agree with Frank Winston about why we write?
Well, it goes on, and let me just get to the end of that section, and I'll have to summarize it here because we don't have that much time. The character here, Markland, goes to one of the microphones to ask a question. He raised his hand, and Winston calls on him and says, "Yes, what's your question?" So he goes up. But he doesn't have a question. He doesn't have a question. So Winston tries to draw him out. "Why do you write?" In effect. And the man is thinking, and all eyes are on him, and he feels like he's in a glass booth. People are looking at him, and he's got to answer that question in front of 100 people. Yeah, not why do we write, why do I write?
Right.
He doesn't have an answer to the question. He runs away. It's a crisis for him.
It's the existential crisis that sets up the arc of the rest of the novel.
Yeah, it's the moment for sure.
Yeah.
And there's stuff that goes on in between. Do I agree with – no, I'm a cynic. I think a lot of people want to be published, but they may think they have something to say. Why wouldn't they want to be published? You know, they want to be heard. We think of people who do caveman art, supposedly that they wanted to leave their mark. It's a human experience to leave your mark. Why not? So while I'm cynical, I'm not that cynical. But to say it's to contribute to art or the love of art or that people really love writers, you know, maybe. That's all I can say. Meaning some people are sincere and some are not. And that comes through in the book when he joins this commune. Some people are quite sincere. I'm not putting down everybody. I know one person who interviewed me and who saw the beginning of the book thought, oh, yeah, it's going to be an expose. I'm going to trash everybody. But then she said, no, you didn't actually do that. As she read the book, you know, you didn't do that. That almost was not a good marketing decision on me because being even-handed, it doesn't work. Almost I have to either trash everybody or love everybody. That's how I feel now, so that I can win over one constituency or the other. But as we know, when there's polarization, the truth is somehow somewhere in the middle, and that's what I really think.
I just heard the heart of a journalist coming out there. How is writing fiction different from journalism?
Well, let me start from the beginning with John Gardner. He's a great novelist. I liked his On Nickel Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it was called. Much better than his more famous book called Grendel, which he himself trashed. He thought Grendel was the only book he ever wrote just to get criticism, get the art critics and the book critics to like him. But he himself did not like the book. He was much more of a humanist than a lot of book critics were at the time. But he wrote a how-to book, because he taught creative writing, on becoming a writer. And he had advice, one paragraph advice to journalists who want to become writers. One word, not just one paragraph, don't, he said. And then he explained why, and while obviously either I'm going against his advice or I'm beating my head against a wall maybe, he said journalists will have too many subject predicate sentences. The sentences will be too short. They'll be describing either unnecessary detail and not enough detail. They're too bound in getting the record straight. While in art, you're getting at the truth, but kind of behind the surface is what you're trying to do. And that's a struggle. And I saw that he was right in some of my early writing. And in part, that's why I've concentrated on short stories, and I've had more success.
I wondered if that was kind of a bridge from your journalistic writing and your nonfiction long-form writing.
It really was. Well, in part, you have a better chance to get published, realistically, with short fiction. Also, there was a fellow, I was going to remember his name. He wrote the Father Dowling Mysteries, a Notre Dame University professor, a scholar, a theologian, really. And he was a very successful author of the Father Dowling movies, which were made into a TV series in the 80s. And I interviewed him when that series was with Tom Bosley, was the actor. And I went up to Notre Dame to talk to him. And I sought some advice from him. You're not supposed to kind of on the side talk to your sources, but I did because he was successful. And he said, Abe, you have to do short stories first. Don't try to do a novel first. See if you can do short stories successfully. Get your feet wet. See if you like doing fiction. It's like proving yourself in the minor leagues. People who do short stories full time, maybe like Alice Munro or she'd be upset, or Elizabeth Strout, who I'm reading now, they'd be upset if I said the short stories are minor leagues. But in a way, they are. You know, it's how you get started. I did not take his advice. This was 25 years ago. I just didn't listen to him. I said, no, I want to do novels, but I had no time to do novels. Mm-hmm. I was working at the Star. He was one of these guys who got up at 4 in the morning as a theologian before he went to talk about the popes and to talk to his students, because he was an expert on papal history. He wrote his little novels. He lived in two worlds, which was quite amazing. I didn't feel I was strong enough to do that, you know, just in terms of will. But I also didn't like the advice. I didn't want to hear it, you know, do short stories first. So there was a kind of arrogance or impudence on my part. After I retired from the Star, there was one nonfiction book. I've had 6 nonfiction books published. I had to finish that. It was on the auto industry crisis, and it was at the time of the auto industry crisis in America and in Indiana. So that book was fairly successful. Then I was going to do fiction, and I've been doing it. And there's a couple of novels besides this that are completely unpublished. one of which I think is quite a bit better, but it got nowhere. And then short stories, I had about a dozen short stories published in 4 years, which is not a bad record, except I think of all the rejections I've got. I get a lot more. It's funny, I get, you know, you get a short story rejected 9 times, and then the 10th time somebody says, yeah, we like it. Can we? Is it still available?
Wow.
Is it still available?
That's a happy moment, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Well, the irony of, is it still available? Well, let me check my files here. Well, I'll have to say no to the New Yorker. I'll give it to you instead.
Let me get back to you on that. I'll have my assistant get back to you on that, right?
Yeah. My people will get in touch with your people.
You know, there are wonderful characters that Robert Markland encounters as he makes his way across the country to the Monastery of Writers, loosely based on a real place in Indiana.
Right.
And I wonder if some of those, did you start, I'm asking a question about craft here, did you start by writing a profile of Penelope, the woman who Robert has the conversation with about going to the Frank Winston talk. Penelope turns up later, maybe Valerie. Did you start with character sketches of those folks, or did you what was your process like? How did you realize those characters?
I did not have a copious notes of people that I was going to put into the book. I had an idea, you know, maybe a 2-page outline of where I wanted the book to go. I wasn't quite sure how it would end. I knew he'd leave home. He'd have adventures. He'd have some. There was going to be. Somebody said there was more sex in the book than I thought there was. But in fact, a couple of reviewers thought there was quite a bit of sex there.
Mostly in his head.
Yeah, that was it. Because I had to think, what would a middle-aged guy who runs away from home, what would he really be like? What would he really do? I think that was outlined in my mind. So. The Valerie character is a little like Marilyn Monroe in the movie Bus Stop. She's a little bit like Lana Turner in The Postman Always Rings Twice. It's not so good that I'm basing literary characters on people I've seen in the movies. On the other hand, the basic character on Lana Turner and Marilyn Monroe is not bad. Okay,
right.
So,
and it's a real it's a real type, and in turn, those were written for the movies because of real life people.
Yeah, and it's like, and I you know, just the kind of the small town seductress, and but he's on an adventure. He's going into a new world. What is a new world to him? And you know, he's fooling around with the natives from his point of view, and he doesn't know that it's his fantasy. On the other hand, it's a common male fantasy, and I don't think it's mine, but I think for a lot of people. So he was going to have an affair with somebody. My question was, would it be with a fellow writer? Well, he wants to with a fellow writer.
Sure.
Because he meets Penelope again, but she's above. You know, she's the not the ice princess, but she is the princess, and she's not doing it with anybody. So she actually knows where she's headed. And some of the other people, they're headed to being successful writers.
Mm-hmm.
He's more into discovering himself, whether he realizes it or not. But I think eventually he realizes that's all he was. And then, you know, he knows how far he's going to go. He achieves a mature understanding of what he is and what the possibilities really were for him, and he goes back home. The book was going to end that way. He wasn't going to commit suicide. He wasn't going, you know, jump out the window. He threw one of his manuscripts out the window, but he wasn't going to jump out after it. And it was his, you know, his year on the run, and then he goes back home. So
there's
in that
a sense of
I
renewal.
Achieved what I wanted. It was well, you know, sometimes you know, he recommitted to his family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a crisis.
Yeah.
I thought in terms of. It would be a, you know, midlife crisis. That's what it was. It was very human that way. Nothing unusual. Maybe it wasn't unusual enough, you know, but as far as being dramatic from a literary point of view. The other character there, some of the people I had were people I have known, people I have met, not necessarily as writers, more so in a manuscript I'm trying to move now that I think very highly of. Based on that auto industry crisis, I have what I call 3 working-class heroes, all modeled after union leaders in small Indiana towns that I met in 2008 and 2009. They were all local presidents, by local, capital L, and they were all really impressive guys. One was a former boxer, went to work in the factory. One was a former minor league baseball player, went to work in the factories. One was a musician who did these you know, like Holiday Inn type stuff, you know, all guys who never got as far as they wanted to go. That seems to be a theme with my writing, people who didn't quite make it as far as they wanted to go.
It's a pretty common theme.
Well, I think so.
That people relate to.
Yeah. This will seem tangential, but I was watching a rerun of Law & Order Criminal Intent, and there's some musicians, young musicians in New York, and part of it, and one guy kills another so he can move up the ladder. You know, it's got to be a murder, right, because it's Law & Order. But in the dialogue between the detective and the guy says, you know, there's 10,000 people come every year to New York. Maybe 1,000 have talent. Maybe 100 out of that 1,000 will get some gigs. Maybe 10 out of that 10,000 will actually become somebody you'd recognize the name. But you know, a lot of them had talent. It's like I interviewed once with a Long Island newspaper many, many years ago. And they said, well, if we get 1,000 applicants, maybe 100 are qualified, maybe 10 are really good. We're only going to hire one. These were in the days when 1,000 people would apply for a newspaper job. I don't think it would happen like that. But there are always people who are close, and it's painful, you know, not to really make it. So that's a theme I do write about.
Sharon Gamble with writer Abe Amador. His new novel is called Monastery of Writers, and it's available on Amazon.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m. when I'll find out about a gallery exhibit for very young collectors.
I'll get a preview of what Clues Hall is offering later this winter and this spring.
And I'll take a look at what the theater program at Marion is up to. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.